I mean, you've been putting in work for so long.
Putting a lot of work.
What's going on, guys? Welcome back to Putting in Work, episode 87 of the interview podcast on the 8-Bit Collective, powered by Audio Technica. I'm your host, John O'Peck, and this week we've got Ashley Ringrose from SMG Studio on the show. Very excited to get into that with you. But first of all, a bit of housekeeping. The iTunes review of the week goes to Dylan Tickell. 5 stars, and he says, Jono uses his knowledge and passion as a gamer / journalist / author / musician and NBA fanatic to produce informative and inspiring interviews with his guests, allowing them to share their expertise through well-researched, thought-provoking questions. Keep putting in the great work. Wow, what a review. It's almost like you studied communications or journalism or media or something at university. Thank you, Dylan. Love your work. And keep those iTunes reviews coming, dear listeners. They do help out the show a lot, so if you can find it in your heart to leave one, you'll be my best friend forever. And hey, if not, maybe you could just come up to me and tell me in person how much you love the podcast. I'm going to be at PAX Australia in Melbourne in a few weeks' time. I'd love to meet anyone out there listening to this. If you can't find me on the show floor because there's thousands of people there, I will be involved in a couple of panels, which is really exciting. There's one, an Audio Technica panel called Before You Go Live, which I'm pleased to be part of with my good friend Brendan from The Hungry Gamers, head of 8-Bit. We'll be giving our audio advice, tips and tricks, all that good stuff to help any podcasters, YouTubers, streamers out there who have questions about the whole setup process. I'll be interviewing a few people on that panel, so come along for some expert tips. There's also a Mario Tennis Aces Invitational, bit of a competition happening on the Sunday that I'll be part of, competing against a bunch of other podcasters and streamers. So that will be good fun, I'm sure. It's going to be a great weekend, and I'm planning to do a whole lot of interviews with some really cool people. So there should be a good month or so of content to come out of that event. Now, today's guest, Ashley, is the head of SMG Studio, an Australian independent game developer, mostly based in Sydney. They've got a few people in Melbourne too, but they are mostly known for Death Squared, which came onto consoles over the last couple of years and really seemed to make a bit of a mark on the Nintendo Switch. I believe they've sold more than 52,000 units, which is pretty impressive for a team of about 25 people. And some of their other games they've worked on, mostly in the mobile space, such as Thumb Drift, that's sold more than 10 million units. I guess they're free downloads, so probably shouldn't say sold, but you get the idea. They've also worked on Risk mobile game version of the board game. They've had a chance to be involved with some Marvel licensed games on mobile devices. So yeah, these guys have been around for quite some time and they know exactly what they're doing and what they do well. So it was really great to talk to Ashley about the business side of running a studio, because he, you know, used to be involved in the coding and development side of it, but now he's kind of moved into more of that supervision side of things, where it's someone making sure that things get done, making sure that contracts are in place, making sure invoices are paid and that the business can operate, because there's such a huge part of it when it comes to securing these licenses and making enough games to pay the bills, but then deciding it's time to work on a new intellectual property and putting something out on a console like Death Squared. Marketing is such a huge part of it. And I think that marketing is probably the thing that made me most interested in SMG, because they do such a great job with their merchandising and their social media presence. So Ash, being the guy that runs a lot of that stuff and comes up with those ideas, we had a really good chat about their approach to, especially the way they interact with gamers and potential customers. And I think that you're really going to enjoy that. So without further ado, here is Ashley Ringrose. Enjoy the show. Thank you so much for joining me, Ash. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you.
Death Squared is, I guess, what your studio is most well known for. Is there anything pending that people should know about, or is it still under wraps?
We've got a couple of things under wraps, but I mean, depending on what you play, like we're kind of known for our Thumb Drift and One More Line as well, which we released on mobile before that. Sure. Yeah, I think Death Squared's our first console kind of game, so we, you know, brought in a new bunch of fans with that game.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've got a game which we were hoping to announce pretty soon. We were hoping to announce, you know, probably at PAX Oz, but we might delay it just a little bit more, coming out early next year, which is going to be a lot of fun.
I'm sure there's a lot of thought going into those kinds of decisions, isn't there?
Yeah, it's more just having all the right materials ready. So having a good trailer, key art, all that stuff, like the game's ready to show, but it's not ready to show from a, you know, super wide, you know, you've got one chance to kind of impress people. Mm. So that's the kind of big decision there is if we announce too early, we don't have great materials to show. So, yeah, got to be very strategic with those things when you're a smaller studio. When you're a bigger studio, you can just announce a logo,
yeah,
like Bethesda, and then just worry about it in 4 years' time. So
that's it. Oh, man. Why don't we start with maybe explaining what you do with SMG and how you got there?
Yep. So I'm Ashley. I'm like the studio head, which is just a title, means I do a bunch of stuff without actually having any defined role, if that makes sense.
No position description.
You know, I'm involved in lots of different things, but I don't do coding anymore. I used to be a coder. I don't do the graphical design, but I'll help out on, you know, anything and everything that's required. But I try and free up the actual, you know, the tech team and the designers and that to do their job by doing everything that they shouldn't have to do.
Right.
And SMG, now we're 26 people. We've got 22 in Sydney and I think 4 or 5 in Melbourne. And, yeah, basically, the actual SMG was born out of a company I ran called Soap Creative, which I ran since 2002. We've since, merged that with a bigger company. And so now I'm concentrating fully on SMG. Mm. But, you know, the founding team of SMG I'd worked with for 7, 5, 8 years each at Soap. So we're actually quite a seasoned team. But as SMG, we founded in 2013. So we did a lot of advert games before that, games for different brands, you know, like Unilever brands and different movie titles. We did games for Expendables, stuff like that, you know, more web games.
Sure.
And then kind of got some funding from the Australian government in 2013 and said to ourselves, look, we'll give ourselves 1 year to do our own IP and we'll see how it goes. And it's done pretty well since then. So, yeah, that grew from 4 people now to, 26. Wow.
That's pretty cool. I mean, it might not sound like a lot compared to the big studios, but for an indie studio, that's fairly substantial. Like that's, as of today, that's more than Telltale has from their recent downsizing.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah. I think 25 is a good size. And, you know, hearing about that Telltale stuff today, it's like it's unfathomable for me to think how to run a team of 250, or there would have been like 250, 300 people. But, you know, you need to get to a certain size to do certain size projects. We have multiple projects on the go at once. For us, we like having multiple projects where there's a small one, a big one, mobile and console, just to allow, you know, a variety of, you know, a variety of teams to work on projects, but also income coming in at a constant stream. Because if you just work on one big project, there's, you know, if it could be a couple of years, 3, 4 years before you see any income from it. So it's quite hard to, you know, manage a company that way.
And you mentioned not being able to do code or not doing coding anymore. Is that your background? Like, how did you get into the industry to begin with?
Yeah, I studied graphic design and went into a digital agency and I started learning Flash. So, you know, I owe my career and everything to Flash. There's a bunch of us that, even Mark, who's in my team, he founded FlashKit, which if you're a Flash person, you'd know that site was one of the biggest at its time. I actually spoke at Mark's conference at FlashKit back in 2001, I think. So, I was making, I probably made like 50 to 80 Flash games myself, and the team at Soap had probably made 250, 300 Flash games over the 16 years. So, you know, quite a lot of games. And, you know, a lot of my, Pat, who's part of the team, Ilya, who was part of the team, and Henrik before that were all Flash guys. So, yeah, we're kind of got a big Flash heritage. And so that was kind of my background. And then everyone else was much better than me. You know, I was AS2. So if anyone knows Flash, you know, that's as far as I went. I was very fast and very scrappy with that. But anything AS3 and above was just above my comprehension. And, you know, I realized I was, you know, much more valuable doing more of the business management and kind of the running of a studio than the actual coding.
Yeah. I guess that's something you don't really think about business being done by people who have more of a creative background. But was that something you fell into, or was it something that you deliberately thought, I can keep myself in this industry a bit longer if I have that skill instead?
Yeah, I definitely fell into it, and I've made a lot of mistakes and I've learned a lot over the time. You know, I've done a little bit of training now. Even just coming to terms with the word boss was quite a hard thing to swallow, just having, you know, people introduce me and say, hey, this is my boss, and I'd go like, oh, that feels so bad. But, you know, now I've learned to maybe not embrace it, but I've learned to accept it as being a valid thing. Yeah. But yeah, definitely, I think you don't know what you don't know sometimes, and in some ways we've done some really good things by not knowing how you're meant to do it, and other times we've made a lot of mistakes. So, yeah. You know, it's kind of a double-edged sword in that way. But, you know, we've done okay. We're not, you know, I think if we had been properly business savvy, you know, from SOAP, you know, it would have been a couple hundred people or something. But, I mean, for me, if you just treat people fairly and honestly and be honest with, you know, everyone, then, you know, you can kind of get through things without too much drama. So that's kind of how that's kind of my management philosophy, if you will.
That's good. Was it a case of looking around at a bunch of devs who've been working on a game and thinking, well, someone has to do the grunt work with the business side of it. Someone has to register the ABN and look at the accounting and all, and like the office space. Is that kind of how you fell into it?
Yeah, I mean, because I'd started SOAP with a couple of other guys in 2002, I kind of had learnt that. So I was doing, you know, at the very start, doing the MYOB, you know, sending invoices, and, you know, my day to actually do the work would start at like 6 p.m. because I'd spend the whole day just doing invoices or quotes and stuff like that. So I did have, you know, from 2002 to 2013, you know, I had a lot of experience, you know, learning the ropes that way. But in terms of when starting SMG and more of a formal game studio, you know, the guys that were really good at coding, you know, didn't like filling out forms, and the guys who were really good at coding were great at ideas but weren't great at putting together a pitch doc or, you know, presentations. So that, you know, I just filled in all the gaps around their skills. And so I had, you know, really good artists, really good coders, really good tool makers and animators. Yes, they probably could have filled out forms and done all the business management, but they didn't have any sales skills. So, yeah, I kind of filled in all the gaps around it.
Sure.
And I kind of consider myself like the hustler of the team, and I've met other studios like I think it's Witchbeam. You know, they're a small team, but then Nart, who's there, you know, he's another hustler. And, you know, I think every studio kind of needs that hustler there to kind of, you know, move stuff along, make deals happen, find deals. If you're just making – you can get along with just making games only, but I think you also need that kind of business acumen, that kind of businessman person to kind of make things happen.
Sure. And I imagine moving away from the creative side, it sounds less fun, if that's a term you can use about work.
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely less fun. I mean, that's why I still dip my hand in when we're coming up with ideas or, you know, on that side. But it is less fun, and it can be satisfying though when you get a deal through, or, you know, you win a pitch.
Sure.
When we did the work for Hasbro for Risk, you know, we had to pitch for that. We had to, you know, so winning that was a big win. When we did the work when we did Thumbdrift, you know, I was heavily involved in the more marketing side. You know, and that's another part of my role, is more like the marketing social side, and, you know, had a big win with that, and, you know, how we kind of engaged a lot of other of the car scene and influencers and stuff. So, you know, those things are, you know, I wouldn't say fun, they're more satisfying to when they pull, you know. I'm kind of like that guy in the A-Team, the old guy that's like, I love it when a plan comes together.
Nice.
You know, you've got the muscle, you've got the BB Baracus, and, you know, the other guys. So, yeah, I kind of consider, you know, running a studio, you need to have like, your A-Team, but you need to have, everyone has their role. Mm. And I think the hustler, the kind of, I say hustler, but yeah, the kind of more business side of things, the studios that do well kind of have one of those people in there.
I guess it's all for nothing if you've made this great game that no one knows about and it doesn't have any support behind it.
Exactly. And a lot of the times, especially with Death Squared, you know, when we launched pretty flat because we launched, you know, just after the Switch came out. This is on the other consoles, Breath of the Wild, Horizon Zero Dawn, all these games were taking all the oxygen out. And it's only been now, you know, with the Switch launch, which was been great for us, and kind of the Games of Gold and the Twitch Prime deals that came, you know, over a year later, that, you know, we're really seeing a good return on investment on the game. So, you know, managing that portfolio of titles, you know, looking after the long tail of a game is where I'm spending most of my time now on those games, you know, while the main dev, Pat, you know, hasn't done much on the game for the last 6 months, you know, checking in, we're doing a few level updates, you know, it's been mainly me just trying to see how we can squeeze as much juice out of the fruit as we can.
Yeah, I imagine it's a tough process to manage whether you move on to the next game that's going to earn you some more money or to support the game that's out there and to even just promote it. Because, I mean, even myself, like I've written a book, I'm working on a second book, and I had to reach a point where I was like, when do I stop putting my energy into promoting the first one and start working on the second? And I imagine that it's the same for you guys.
It's exactly the same. And luckily we have multiple titles, so we can kind of keep jumping around. But yeah, I've definitely, I mean, that's probably one thing we haven't done that well is support our titles in the longer term. Death Squared's been a little bit different because we've have had some success on the Switch, because we kind of get bored of, you know, we work on a game, you work on it so long, you get sick of it, and then we just want to work on the next game, because making a game and, you know, seeing it through is kind of the exciting part. The sustaining a game or supporting it actually isn't the fun part, because you've solved all the problems, you've had all the praise, or, you know, you've seen people play it, and then it's like, well, now I want the new challenge. So yeah, I mean, we're much more on the case of, oh, sorry, we're much more pushing towards, you know, releasing new games, because, you know, again, we haven't had the huge success that, you know, one game can sustain the studio for multiple years forever, you know, multiple years without doing any work. So it's a bit different. But yeah, I think we kind of have a little bit short attention span when it comes to games and just want to work on the next one.
Yeah, right.
Because that's the most exciting part's the kind of concept creation and that kind of world building and that first prototypes and stuff, and then you realize, oh, we have to finish and ship this game. So yeah, it is a balance, and I think that's where some studios can fall down, where they just keep putting all their eggs into one basket, and then they realize, okay, we need to make a new game, and then there's a 1 or 2 year lull before the next game comes out, and, you know, that's when your revenue really goes down. So yeah, managing a portfolio is a tough one.
Yeah, and I imagine on that kind of management side as well, it would take a lot of financial restraint to look at, well, we're not going to make a lot of money off any of our projects for a long time because of the cycle and how it can take quite some time to put out a game. Is that why you have these deals with Hasbro and the other, like, mobile games and that kind of thing, to kind of keep some revenue coming in while you work on the, I guess, the tentpole releases?
Yeah, I mean, for us, the mobile titles were our tentpole releases, right. And even Risk for Hasbro is actually right now is our biggest game. I think the console markets are, yeah, kind of a different beast. We're not really, you know, a studio set up for, you know, big titles. So, you know, we kind of like having the smaller titles where, you know, like a hyper casual game, we can, you know, do that in 1 to 3 months and release it and see how that goes. You know, I think console doesn't allow you that kind of experimentation. So part of that's born, like I said, from our short attention span, and part of it's due to a necessity to keep the studio viable. So, yeah, I think it's born out of, we started with the mobile titles, but now it's kind of a, you know, it's a much more strategic plan to keep us viable, to have multiple streams of income, you know, multiple size titles than just having the really big ones.
Sure.
You know, I can't imagine, I couldn't imagine working at something like a bigger studio where you just work on one game for 4 years and then release it. And then that's your cycle. Like, there must be people in there that just want to release a really small game for fun, or they have a really nice prototype that's like, well, that's cool, but, you know, how does that expand to a bigger game? That must be a really weird feeling, because, you know, if we have a really fun little prototype, it's like, oh, yeah, well, we can spin that off in a couple of months. And then, you know, while we're working on another game. So, yeah, I think, you know, I like our situation now where we can, you know, experiment and do other, you know, lots of little things and putting all the risk into one big project.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I want to talk about the marketing you mentioned before, because that's something that I, like, just as a casual observer, felt like you guys have done a really good job with. I remember going to RTX Sydney 2017 and seeing you guys had a pretty big presence there. I think that some of the panels were playing the game, and you had the big cubes that you were throwing around with the audiences. Was that, like, I mean, let's just, like, tell me about where the approach came from to promote this game and all those extra things that you went into that go beyond just trying to get, you know, a trailer on Twitter or whatever it is for a lot of cases.
Yeah, I think we were quite lucky with Death Squared because everything was a cube based. So cubes are actually really easy to merchandise. Yeah. So the inflatable cubes were really easy to make. We made plushies and stuff. RTX was great. I think Cam, who kind of ran it that year and the year before, kind of, because we had a good relationship there, he set us up so we could have the game on the stage, which was great. The inflatable cubes, which we made purely for the booth, we realized that we could throw them into the crowd. So we started doing that at PAX and RTX, so we could throw those into the crowd while, you know, the crowds are waiting to get in. And the inflatables were just, you know, hey, I've got a, you know, wouldn't it be cool? Oh, initially we're going to do like a big inflatable one that would hang above our booth. And we got that made in China. And then we got it in. We ordered some helium, brought it to the office, filled it up, and then it was like half full. And we're like, what? And we rang the helium place and we said, you know, hey, I think that the tank you gave us was half empty or something because it's not full. And they said, what are the dimensions of this cube? And I'm like, oh, it's 1.5 meters by 1.5 by 1.5. And then we had ordered just the we hadn't ordered enough helium because it was the cube amount. So it was like 1.5 by 1.5 times 1.5. It was like 9 cubic meters or something like that.
Right.
You know, I can't do the math. And we'd ordered like 5. And the cost of that helium was like $300-$400. So we realized like, oh, it's going to cost us like $800-$900 to fill this every time. It's it's not going to be worth it. So we kind of just had – we had smaller ones made just for fun. So we ended up using those the most. But, you know, that was just when we're trying to dress the booth, you know, we don't have a huge budget. So we're trying to think like, what can we do to dress the booth? What can we do that's going to be reusable as well? And so the cubes, you know, are actually really good value for that. I think each of them costs us like $80. So we've, you know, used them at multiple shows and just trying to be as economical and scrappy as we can with the booth. And for us, the, you know, getting on the stage, and then when we knew we were going to be on stage, I thought, oh, we'll do a Wii Fit, you know, hack so we can have the game played on the Wii Fit to make it on stage a little bit more exciting.
Right.
So it was luckily the team, you know, I'm usually coming up with, you know, a lot of stupid ideas, and the team are kind of either roll their eyes and go, okay, Ash, well, yeah, we'll do that. And anytime I have something that's really bad idea, they usually shoot it down pretty fast. But, you know, a lot of the time it's just we have an idea and it should be a bit of fun and, you know, it's not going to cost too much. So we just do it. You know, because I guess, you know, we're a small team, so we can kind of make those silly decisions. We've made custom consoles, yeah.
And do you think that's been effective? Like, do you think that's been part of the reason you've had the success you have?
I think it's definitely helped on the long tail. I know I've been really kind of noisy about the game, definitely on Reddit, the Nintendo Switch Reddit's, you know, been a really nice community, and we've just constantly kept making noise when Smash Brothers Ultimate was announced. You know, there was a guy who did a really awesome Labo Man animation for Labo Man for Smash, and I contacted him, realized he was in Sydney, and I said, "How much will it cost to get a Death Squared Smash animation made?" And he did that over a couple of weeks, or I think 4 or 5 weeks in his spare time. So just always looking for opportunities to kind of you know, bring our game into, you know, the conversation through like more like content marketing and having a bit of fun. And sometimes that works well, sometimes it doesn't. we've had great success with announcing our sales before we have a sale. So we had a thing where it's like, hey, we're going on sale for the first time on Switch. And I told the community, like, I think it was 3-4 days before it actually happened. And we got a lot of praise for that. So we've just been doing that, you know, ever since, because I didn't want people to buy the game and then, you know, the next day it goes on sale, because that would really suck. So even just that initiative got us a lot of praise, got us a lot of, you know, people saying like, hey, I'm going to buy the game now. And even though part of my ploy was telling people not to buy the game so that we can compress all the sales into one shorter period to try and chart. But you know, so it was a little bit of a marketing ploy, but a lot of the time it was just, you know, how do we treat our fans, you know, with more respect, and, you know, how can we make news when we don't have actually anything else to talk about? So
yeah,
it was always trying to find different angles to have fun with the game.
No, I think that for someone that hasn't like studied marketing or anything, it's really impressive what you've been able to do with this small game. And how much influence, well, how much influence do influencers have in terms of the sales and awareness for a game like yours? Because I've seen a few notable streams of this, whether it's like someone at IGN playing it or Kind of Funny guys doing a Let's Play. So have tangible results, or is it more just it's cool to see the game getting recognized by people with a large audience?
Yeah, it definitely has an impact on sales. I mean, we've had free games, so it's like Thumbdrift, you have a lot more of an impact because the game's free, so people see it and they're like, great, I'm just going to download it now. When it's a paid game, it's pretty much more of a longer, you know, it's like a sum of all parts. So they might see it on, you know, Kind of Funny. Greg and his team have been, you know, really supportive of the game, but then they might see it there, they might see it on IGN, and then when they see it on the store, they're like, oh, they're already familiar with it. Yeah. So it's definitely a sum of all parts. I've seen other developers say like, look, here's when the video went live and here's the bump in sales and that's it. You know, it didn't seem worth it, but it's like, well, no, because it all adds up. You know, it's not like you see one ad on TV and then you think, well, that's it, I'm going to go buy it. You know, you see it over and over again.
Yeah.
And I consider it all part of that. And channels like You're Kind of Funny and other ones like that, where they may not have the biggest audience, but they've got a better audience in a way, because
yeah, they're really loyal and
They're also, you know, sometimes a little bit older than, you know, some of the bigger channels where it's all, you know, 12-year-old kids, and that's the ones where free games work really well, which is why Fortnite does amazing, because it's, you know, it's free at the start. So yeah, I think those things definitely help. Having IGN, you know, say, give us a great quote saying, you know, it's like their favorite co-op Switch game at the time. You know, I use that all the time. I just, you know, send people that URL. When people say, oh, I want to play a co-op game, it's like, boom, here's what IGN said, you know. Those are kind of amazing things. So yeah, it's a combination of all things. We've had a lot of people say, hey, I saw this on Kind of Funny, or I saw Stumped playing this, you know, and also people watch those videos over time. They're not all the views don't happen in the first week. So
sure,
you get a lot of long-term kind of value from that. And for us, the tail on Switch and for Death Square has been really good. So, you know, we're still doing good numbers now, you know, mm-hmm. more than a year and a half later. So, you know, I think it's just there's a lot of media out there now that, you know, people slowly see. So review sites definitely help in the initial burst. But it's that content later on that, you know, kind of gives you that longer tail.
If those influencers doing videos are so effective, is it something that you're actively trying to generate, or is it kind of just giving out the codes when they're requested and hoping that the content does that itself?
We definitely want to foster those relationships. And I think channels like Stumped and Kind of Funny, Treesicle and places like that, you know, I try to, you know, stay in touch with them. Our next game, I've given a few of them some early access to it, just to say, hey, I want to get your feedback. Please, you know, obviously it's all confidential, but I want to get their feedback. So trying to, you know, have a two-way relationship with them rather than just being like, here's our game, can you promote us? You know, sometimes it's like, hey, you guys should look at this, you know, check out this, you know, trying to add value to them versus just seeing them purely as a marketing tool. You know, for some of them, I've tried to hook them up with other deals and, yeah, just be a you know, kind of not always see it as a one-way street or, you know, what can they do for me? It's like, well, what can I do for them? And I think that's important. I think that's part of, you know, when I say my management style of playing fair and or being honest, it's also trying to add value. You know, if you just look at people purely for the, you know, what can they do for me, it's very short-term thinking. So, you know, I feel like I've tried to add a lot of value to, you know, anyone, you know, even small streamers, big streamers, you know, other devs, you know, trying to help out where I can to add value because, you know, in the long run, it'll pay dividends. I think that's kind of like business karma, if you will. I think more people should consider, you know, what's their studio karma like? Because for us, you know, we're trying to, you know, be as positive as we can.
Yeah. And I mean, going back to what you said before about when people ask what's a good co-op game, it sounds like you're talking about your social media engagement and the, I guess, personality that you've got over there. So is that something that you find being proactive and getting on Twitter and responding to people or doing searches and replying to people has been effective as well?
Yeah, I've got like TweetDeck set up with, you know, Switch games and indies and, you know, co-op games. And I try and, I used to have like, I just got a Nintendo Switch because people would tweet that. And so I'd just reply back saying, check out our games. But nice. You know, that's a glance every day to see what's there and see if I can reply. And I've had some good success with that. And, you know, it's not much work, but again, it's just trying to be that, bit active. And if I see someone that's, you know, could be a musician or sometimes it's even like a TV producer or something says, you know, oh, what game should I play with my kids or something like that? You know, I chime in there and I say, hey, I'll throw you a free code, if needed. So, you know, it's small return, but, you know, but it's a small amount of work. And, you know, if one of those trigger something bigger, then it should pay off. But, you know, you know, I think you just got to be quite noisy. If you have a huge successful game, it will kind of success begets success. So it'll just snowball. But that's why I talk about being a hustler. You have to kind of, you know, just keep at it and, you know, keep pushing because it's definitely a lot harder on the paid games than the free games. Free games, it's like, hey, you like cars? Check out Thumbdrift. And people just download it because it's like it's free. You know, there's no barrier to entry. But when it's like, hey, you like puzzle games? Like, yeah, well, here's a $15 game. They're like, I don't know. So, and also if it's on a console, it's like, you know, mobile, you're always one click away. So, yeah, it's definitely been a big learning experience, you know, pushing a premium title than a free title. And, you know, I wish I had the success of, you know, some of the games where they, you know, they're selling hundreds of thousands of copies, you know, a week. Because then I wouldn't be doing any of this because I'd be counting all the money because, you know, getting an extra sale from a tweet that is you know, a drop in the ocean.
Sure. So I want to ask about, I guess, just the Australian industry in general. If you look at this year alone, we've had obviously Hollow Knights come over to Switch and soon to PS4 made by Team Cherry over in Adelaide, I think. The Gardens Between is out as of this week, and that's on PS4. I think it's on Switch as well.
Yeah, it's on Switch and Steam as well, yep.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's still early days, but hopefully, I mean, it's already getting some exposure, so it's cool to see that happening, you know, internationally. What is it like to be an Australian developer? Because it seems like we've got a lot of success stories, but there's also probably, I imagine, a lot of studios that struggle to get noticed. And is it as simple as if you make a great game, it will get noticed, or it's you know, a really tricky thing to make that splash elsewhere?
Well, I think you use the word great, and I think that's the if you make a great game, then job done. I think look at House with Untitled Goose Game. You know, I think that was I was at PAX West and, you know, that one had a line around their booth the entire show. You know, I don't know if it's a great game. It looks amazing. But if you make something that, you know, captures people's attention, and I think with that Untitled Goose Game they did, Hollow Knight, Gardens Between, you know, Hollow Knight's smashed it everywhere and it's still get talked about, you know, years later. I think so. You know, I think they're coming out on Xbox next week as well. So, yeah, I think making a good game is different than making a great game. And I think, yeah, so a great game, yeah, your job's done for you. Make a good game, then you have to, you know, hustle a bit harder to get noticed. And that, and I think the issue we have in Australia is just because we're so isolated that, you know, getting access to the international press is quite tough. Every event is a international flight and extra cost. But I feel like, you know, we do punch above our weight here in Australia. You know, you've got Defiant with Hand of Fate doing amazing stuff. And even their, even Hand of Fate board game, I was at Gen Con in Indianapolis, you know, and there was people playing, there was people playing that game. So, you know, you got League of Geeks with Armello. There's been some big successes. You've got Fire Monkeys in Melbourne that are always doing real racing. So, you know, there's a lot of success. I think we're just, we're heavily isolated, but also we've got a bit of tall poppy syndrome that we try not to big up ourselves too much, which is weird. but I feel like the industry, you know, if we all work together, and I think there's a lot more push to work together instead of work against each other. But yeah, it is tough, but it's tough in every industry, you know. Like, I don't know anyone from the, I think there's one studio I know from South Africa, you know, their game industry. You know, I know a lot of Canadian studios, you know, they all face the same problems we have, just they're a little bit more easy to get access to press and events. But the issue is, like you said, you know, you got to make a great game rather than a good game.
Sure. Okay. So what would you say has been the hardest part of building the studio to where it is now?
Definitely managing, I think, for me personally, managing people has been tough. That's a tough one because everyone has their own different life stages. Everyone has their own expectations as to, you know, what we should do and what we shouldn't do. And, you know, if running a business was easy, everyone would do it. So, you know, that's been a tough one. I think, definitely managing growth as well. Like part of, you know, if you want to grow the team, it's not like, you know, talented people grow on trees. So you have to, you know, that's probably another big issue in Australia. It's just hard to find enough talent, you know, around. And now with the visa laws changing, it's actually making it a lot harder to get a 457 visa in Australia. So, you know, there's a lot more marketplace labor testing, and that involved where it used to be a lot easier. So, you know, it's still easier than some countries to get a visa here. You know, you can get a 417 working holiday visa. But yeah, attracting talent or saying, hey, you know, leave America or leave the UK and come all the way over to Australia. It's, you know, it kind of works for someone who doesn't have a, you know, a wife and kids and, or, you know, sorry, or a partner or kids. And, but it's a, you know, it's a lot harder to have people, senior people kind of move over. So, I think that attracting talent's been a tough one as well. And we're lucky we did a few projects as Soap, you know, in the US. So getting a project like Risk with Hasbro and stuff like that, you know, we had that experience. If we didn't, you know, it would have been almost impossible to kind of pitch and win, you know, a big project like that without having that previous experience. So, and even just getting access to that kind of opportunity was, you know, quite lucky as well. So, yeah. I don't know if I kind of went all around that question, but there's a lot of you know, things that are hard with this industry, and there's a lot of things that are good as well. So
yeah, I mean, I guess it's like TV and film in Australia too. Like they're not easy things to get into, but once people have a company running and making money, it seems like they can tick along all right. And I think what you guys have done seems to be working.
Yeah, Australia seems to definitely fund Australia-wide film and TV a lot more heavily. Like we have a lot of stringent laws in broadcast TV where it's like has to be a certain percentage of Australian content. So that just, you know, basically hands these companies, you know, work and, you know, money on a platter. In gaming, there's no restrictions for that. So, and there's, you know, outside of Victoria, there's no heavy investment in gaming. So, you know, we're at a little bit of a disadvantage there. And then you talk to people in the US and they're like, what? They give money for film and TV? Like that's, you know, because Hollywood's such a machine, like they don't get any funding. You know, it's unfathomable that the government would fund film and TV projects for YouTubers. It's just a unique case. But yeah, I think, yeah, it definitely is. I mean, what's rewarding about it is you can, you know, launch a game, it can go global, you know, you can launch a game globally, whereas with a film, you know, you can't just be on every cinema around the world. You got to get distribution deal, and there's a lot more cost involved in that. So, you know, gaming does have an advantage in that sense.
Okay. So I usually ask for advice about how people can, you know, get into your industry and do what you're doing. But I feel like as an indie that's more established and profitable, maybe you would have some really good advice for people that are already in development, but they're just wondering, like, how do I build my company from 3 people to 10 people or from 10 people to 50 people? And that's something that you might have something to say about.
Yeah, I mean, just make sure that you want to grow your company that big. You know, if you're 3 people, great.
Yeah. Or, I mean, I guess in terms of instead of maybe just focusing on the staff, but more just like making a viable company that will last.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, I think you just need, you need multiple. For us, you know, it's having multiple games, having passive income as well. You know, I think we're trying to get to a certain level of income that comes in without any work being done. So, like from previous titles, that gives you that safety net that, you know, you can work work on, you know, projects that you want to work on. But, I mean, really, it's just have be more strategic with your releases. Also try and, you know, squeeze as much juice out of each title as you can. Just release and forget is probably not the best way, but also, you know, our first game was 18 months. Our second game was built in 2 months. And then we did a whole suite of games that were done in, you know, 2-3 months. So you've try and look at how you can release multiple titles. You know, don't put all your eggs into the, you know, one basket unless you know that basket's amazing. Yeah, so got to be more strategic in that sense. But if you can stay at 3 people, great, because it, you know, just means if you have success, it's going to be divided by 3 rather than divided by 20.
Yeah, as long as one of those people knows how to do all the invoices, you're right.
yeah. But and also, I mean, as a studio, you know, be positive. Like, it's so easy to focus on the negative. Be honest and be fair with people. Because, yeah, it, like I said, studio karma, it'll pay back in dividends later on. It's so much easier to have, you know, a lot of friends in the industry and other industries than have a lot of enemies. So, cool. Yeah.
Okay, last question, Ash. If you could do anything and know that you wouldn't fail, what would you do?
Oh, I mean, me personally, I would probably be like a YouTuber or something like that, like make a comedian.
Okay.
But that's just because, you know, I'd rather just be, you know, like I'd love to be Seinfeld or someone like that.
Stand up or more like sketch comedy?
Either, you know. But yeah, stand up would be great because I think that's on my life goal list is to do a stand up. Set, but I think a lot of people have that as well. But yeah, no, I'm kind of that's for me personally. Just want to do that, or study, do, you know, run a big research study. But you know those studies where you hear like we put 100 people in a room and then divided them by eye color, and I would love to just run like human studies stuff like that. You know, random anthropological studies, or you know. Stuff like that. That's really, I don't see any way to make money or, you know, survive off that, but I think it would just be fun. Yeah.
Just a curiosity, is it?
Yeah. Like social experiments, or, you know, anthropological studies, like marshmallow test, all that stuff gets me, you know, really excited.
Put 100 people in a room, give 50 of them a switch with Death Squared.
Yeah.
And the other 50, don't give them anything. See what happens after 5 hours.
I'd love to. Yeah. Exactly. You know, give someone, it'd be great to just run experiments on people. Not in a bad way, just in a more interesting way.
Yeah. Is there like a dream video game that you have that you'd love to work on or contribute to?
Me? I got asked this question before from a friend. I was like, no, I kind of like making, I don't have the dream game. I mean, we worked on a game to promote Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2 back in the day. And it was like a, I don't know if you played Heroes of Might and Magic, but it was the battle mechanics from that with all the Marvel Ultimate Alliance characters. So, you know, you had Spider-Man and, you know, all the Marvel characters, and they would be able to fuse. And, you know, we made that. That was turn-based multiplayer, and it was hugely successful. And I kind of want to do that again, just because it was a lot of fun having those characters that all have their particular traits and stuff. So, you know, I keep bringing that back up. Up with the team, but it's like, you know, we're never going to get the Marvel license until we can afford a $10 million minimum guarantee or something. So, but I mean, that's something of that. That's probably in my dream list still to do that one.
Sure. Who knows? Maybe one day.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for joining me. It's been really interesting, Ash, and hopefully we can catch up at a future PAX or RTX or something.
Yep, definitely. Yeah, we'll be at PAX Australia. So,
Great.
Come say hi, and then I think we'll that's it for us for the rest of the year, which would be good. Stop traveling, and then we'll hopefully be able to announce our next game. Yeah,
fantastic.
All right, thanks, mate.
Thank you for listening, and thanks to Audio Technica. If you want to get in touch with Ash, you can find him on Twitter at SMG Studio. If you enjoyed the show and you'd like to leave an iTunes review, that would really help out. But if you really want to show some love, pick up some sweet Puttin' in Work merchandise over at 8bit.net/PIW. That's ATEBIT. And of course, that's where you can find the rest of the awesome podcast content from the 8bit Collective. You can, of course, find me on Twitter at Jono himself. And until next week, keep putting in work.